And now it's time for wait a minute. What the hell is the show called again?
It's Chatter on Books. What else do you want me to say? Can I go now?
That's right. It's Chatter on Books. Let's do this thing.
Okay, guys, we are here. Chatter on Books, our 34th episode, which is stunning. And we're in a disclosed location, which makes me very happy because we've been in an undisclosed location for a few weeks here. And we are at East City Bookshop, which is 645 Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast. Lori Gilman, owner here. And I'm going to keep repeating the address, 645 Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast, because this is bricks and mortar, and we want people to come to bookstores like East City Bookshop. So we're very happy to be here. Thank you for having us. Back
Thank
to you soon.
Thank you for coming.
David Aldridge, Jeannie McManus, Michael Kornheiser, Claude Jennings, the most important person in the room. Absolutely most important. And we're thrilled to have everybody from C-SPAN here. God bless you all for being here. And the close members of my family, thank you for being here. We have a really, really good show. And as I realize, this is our last one for a few weeks because we're going to take a few weeks off and retool and take a breath. I really like the show, and I started piling a lot into it. So at some point, someone might need to wave at me and go, slow down, take some segments out. But we've got great things on tap. We have some random thoughts from me, a terrific literary birthday, which we want to discuss. We're going to talk to Lori about the shop and what it's like running a local independent bookstore these days. We're going to talk about freshman reading. If you're a freshman, you should be putting the phone down and the iPad down and reading a book because you probably have required reading. We'll kick that around. And we have as our featured author, David Epstein, who is blowing minds everywhere amongst the angsty type A people, and there are a lot of them in the DMV, with his book, Range, Why Generalists Triumph in a Specialized World. It's a great book. It's very counterintuitive. But first, we also have to talk about Calvert Woodley, featured wine of the evening. Jeannie and David, I'm going to count on you for this one. I was over at Calvert Woodley today, our sponsor, 4339 Connecticut Avenue. There's some people in this room that I know are regular patrons there. And it really is a fabulous place. It's a DC institution. Lori, you've probably been there once or twice. It's a DC institution, the best staff, the greatest selection. And they gave us today a lovely Chardonnay, a Sauvignon Blanc from California, Rombauer. Jeannie, what do you think? 2017?
Again, I always sound like such a fake wine person. It was
that's why we have Michael here, because he's not a fake wine person.
It was not like a New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. It was not over citrusy. It was much milder than that.
It's supposed to have a very long finish. I have no idea what that means. Mm-hmm. Still dry, yeah. And will hold up well in oppressive conditions as we have out there today in your nation's capital.
Yes, I would agree to that.
Yeah, okay. And the cheese is a lovely Boucheron Chèvre French goat's cheese. Ibrahim at La Cheeserie, the internationally famous La Cheeserie. Mary's nodding her head. You like the cheese, Mary?
Yes.
Good. Okay.
And I think Michael's been absorbing the cheese.
You know what? Every time we have the cheese, you always look to me. This is it has a nice earthiness. You can really taste the terroir. So.
It was supposed to have a citrus note to it. Mm. I've never heard of cheeses having notes, but it's supposed to have a citrus note. Okay, but go to Calvert Woodley. Say Chatter 5 at checkout. You get $5 off, which is spectacular. I myself went as a customer to Calvert Woodley not too long ago, and I was pretty excited being there, a customer. I'm in the checkout line, and I forgot to say Chatter 5. But you get $5 off, which is not insignificant. Okay, some random thoughts for today to bounce off all you guys. You can jump in anytime, Lori, but you're going to have your own segment as well. Yeah, her store. Thank you notes. Mike Crowley, Denison professor, we had him on a couple of weeks ago. Fabulous guy, wonderful selection of books called Any Other Place. I think he was one of our most surprising authors.
Yeah.
You guys should have him in here sometime. Wonderful guy. Professor at Denison, born in Appalachia, has this really interesting collection of short stories called Any Other Place. He was delightful. And he wrote two thank you notes, one to the group and one to me. And I'm going to read the note and then I'm going to ask questions about thank you notes. This is to the whole gang, names everybody. Thanks for making it so easy to be on the show. I wasn't a bit nervous because you're all such warm, inviting people. I had so much fun, and I hope to see each of you soon. All the best, Mike. And he sent one to me, which is very personal, so I won't read that one.
Can I just interrupt you for a minute?
Yeah.
So I am the point of contact for this guest.
The reason
we booked
him is because of you.
I received the thank you text, which I think has a very different purpose and place than the thank you note. and I'm a little surprised I did not receive a personal thank you note on that lovely stationery.
He mentioned your name, but that's it.
But okay, my name is his name.
I think this is a gender thing because, okay, Mike, we'll start with you. When is the last time one of you wrote and or received a handwritten note in the mail?
It's not fair for me because with the birth announcements.
Because that's your wife's job?
Tori, I take that personally. That hurts. I write thank you notes that make you weep.
Aww.
No. So, you know, okay. Between weddings, birth announcements, holiday cards, I write my fair share. You know, Liz is much better, and I think that's the tradition in her family. Her mother worked at a school where in her line of work and development, you did write handwritten notes that went out with every single mailing. Her father writes these beautiful missives that go out as well. Great holiday cards, but I do think it's different to get that handwritten note.
Yeah. I'm going to walk around with Mike Crowley's notes for weeks, I promise you. Jeannie, last note?
I wrote you a note.
Yes, you did. It was lovely.
About 2 weeks ago.
Thank
because
you
sent me flowers to my art opening.
Yeah, a day
Thank
late, but
much.
We sent you flowers.
And
yeah.
I took some friends to lunch who had been incredibly supportive of my recent art show, and they wrote me thank you notes.
Nice.
So, I'm an interesting demographic for this, but I would say they're important to me to write and to receive.
Yep. David?
I write thank you notes that make you sleep, not make you weep.
Handwritten, put them in the mail with the stamp?
Absolutely. As I have told you many times, I've kept every letter that's ever been written to me since I was 12 years old, and I will continue to do that.
Wow, I wish I'd kept
those. Are going to be interesting boxes to unpack when you're dead and gone.
Yeah.
I believe in handwriting things, and because I think there's an intimacy to writing that there simply isn't in anything else.
Yeah.
Which is why historians, and being a history major, it really troubles me that we don't write letters anymore. That's how we found out. That's how you really told people who you were and what you felt.
Increasingly, people in government don't write anything down and don't want anything left to be analyzed, to be pulled apart.
Yeah,
Lori, thank you notes?
Well, you might not be surprised to know that we do get a lot of thank you notes from authors.
Nice.
They tend to write on paper.
Good, not just emails.
Editors, not just emails. Very nice notes. I write a lot of thank you notes in my head that are very heartfelt. And I have a lot of plans for the beautiful stationery I'm going to write it down on. And then after a lot of time goes by, I think, oh my God, I need to just send an email or I won't send it at all. So that happens
there is that.
To me a lot.
Yeah, I have a lot of plans in my head when I win the lottery too. So,
right,
yeah.
Exactly. But okay. I do try to do it, and my mother would be ashamed that I don't do it as often as I should.
To authors who would like to be on this show, Mike Crowley can come back anytime. Absolutely anytime. He's delightful.
What is your standard signature on a thank you note?
Standard signature?
Signature.
It depends. It depends. If it's someone with whom I'm very close that, you know, love Tori, something like that. If it's not, it's all the best. And I thought of this when I got Mike's notes in the mail the other day, which I'm going to frame and put on my wall. I thought, okay, the day after shows, I always send an email to the authors and sometimes to you all saying, okay, David, really? Talking too much again. Notes. I often send an email to the authors thanking them and following up and sharing the link, those kinds of things, but I should write them a note. I should get an actual
address. I would say an email or text is better than nothing.
Absolutely. Yes. And I would say, because we are at East City Bookshop at 645 Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast, which I will repeat many times, there are lovely note cards here in the store.
Well, that is part of my aspiration. We have so many beautiful cards and types of stationery that I want to use them all.
Yeah, okay.
They're mostly in my drawer at home, but someday.
Okay, that's done. Random thank you notes are done. Last week, I think, we talked about Megan Rapinoe. U.S. women's soccer star, and what the title of her book would be. She's already signed the deal with Penguin. It's going to come out in 2020, and she's also doing a kid's book. Let me see if I can find
it. Yeah, shortly.
Yeah, coming out. That's really fast, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They moved it up.
And they've gone to great lengths to say this isn't just about soccer. This is about being who you want to be, saying what you want to say, all of these things, which I'm no surprise. God bless her. I hope she gets a huge advance, and I'm a huge fan of hers. So we answered the question last week, does she do a book? Yes. What will it be called? We had great titles. When does she run for office? Michael?
Well, she's already on the four-year cycle, so let's just plus four to right now. She'll be finished with the book tour by then. So, no, it depends. I think you have to realize your personality comes through in different ways. For her, the book itself, the book tour, that might fulfill this need for service that she clearly has. If you see the way she's responded to the media to the microphone, she has something to say. That doesn't mean she necessarily needs to go out and serve in public office. This might just be enough.
Yeah. David, does she remind you of other athletes in any way? Or is she different? Unique?
No, she is sui generis. She, no question, she is one of a kind. I shouldn't say surprised. I don't know that she necessarily automatically runs for office for the simple fact that, you know, her partner is Sue Bird, who is an amazing athlete in her own right and a Hall of Famer in her own right, but is not someone who likes to live in the public eye.
Right.
And is very reluctant sometimes to live in the public eye. But having said that, she's been in the public eye, and so has Megan for a very long time. So circumstance, time of their lives, you know, I don't know them personally, so I can't speak to where they are in their lives and if this is something that calls to them.
I increasingly think the only ones who can get into that level of the public eye are those who are used to it, who can handle the scrutiny and the pressure and the intensity of that and just don't care. She'll get 150 million people who say nice things about her on Twitter. She'll get 125 million who say mean things about her, and she just doesn't care. Mm-hmm. Got a very thick skin, and that's what it takes.
Yes.
Okay, we wish her best, and this is our public appeal. We would like to have her on the show.
Yes.
When she comes out, she's going to go?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
Well, when she's on the show, we can ask her.
Absolutely.
So this, we're out there.
They get C-SPAN wherever she lives, right?
Yeah. And this is my weekly appeal to Sean Doolittle and everyone around him. Sean is a big reader. He is a big supporter of local independent bookstores.
He should visit his local.
He should.
Closest to Nat Stadium.
Well, they have an off day at the end of the week.
Yeah.
Oh, there we go.
The Nats, I mean, just going to throw this out there. When we first thought of this several months ago, I sent an email off to somebody in the Nats organization. They fired right back, which is really good. And said, oh, great. Yeah, he loves it. We'll have him on. And they started throwing out dates for when he would be in town and not playing. Great. And then, and I don't want to be cynical, but about the time the Nats started to tank this spring, it started to backpedal a little bit on that offer, but we still want him. And his wife is a big reader, too.
Yeah, there is a busy schedule off the field as well. We know that he was at a local bookstore up in Cleveland Park this past weekend doing a reading there as well.
This is closer to Nat Stadium.
Yeah, much closer.
Yeah. Well, there's here.
As I told you, there's an open date at the end of August. Where there
might
be
a special pop-up of Chatter on Books.
Could be. You never know.
Do it from the ballpark.
Do it anywhere. We'll do it anywhere. Okay, last thing, and this for randoms, this might be my favorite. Today would be Benito Mussolini's birthday. 1883. That's not a name. The crowd's kind of going, why is she talking about Mussolini? Ben from C-SPAN right now is like on his phone going, get me out of here. Get me out of here. 1883. Who knew he wrote a novel? Anybody? Lori, you're the pro.
I did not know that.
Co-wrote a novel called The Cardinal's Mistress, and I tried hard to find the name of his co-author, who it was. Can't find anything, I thought, because this book was so bad, his co-author was probably killed. But it was, shockingly, it was very anti-clerical, and it was in a serial form. It came out in a serial form. It evidently was dreadful, no surprise there. And it finally got pulled off the shelves or pulled out of whatever circulation it was in because he reached some truce with the Vatican. But I have some excerpts here. It was like a bodice ripper kind of novel. And
just tried to find absolution by the next chapter.
Yeah. I'm going to give this to Michael because Michael's got the nicest voice. I just want you to see these two highlighted sections at the bottom?
I think I can handle the highlighted sections.
Okay, two highlighted sections. This is a reading by Michael Kornheiser of Benito Mussolini's book.
Now, what
book.
Kind of voice would you like for this?
You
take Italian.
Do you have a racy Italian bodice ripper voice?
I did actually take Italian as an undergrad.
Of course you did.
No, don't go there.
Of course you did.
I will build you a secret. Altar in the depths of my conscience. You will be the Madonna of the temple within me. I will be your slave. Tori, pause for one second. You really want me to read this?
You're already in. Go ahead.
I'll remember this.
Yeah.
Strike me, despise me, beat me. Open my veins with a subtle dagger, but grant me the revelation of yourself. Grant that I may speak to you. Grant that I may lose myself with you in the supreme illusion. Ah, you do not listen to me, shameless courtesan harlot. Well, I shall come to get you in this same castle. I shall let the common brutes of the marketplace satiate their idle lusts on your sinful body. You shall be the mockery of the unreasoning mob. Your corpse will not have the rites of Christian burial. You will be cast into the field of the Baduith. turning the page story.
Yeah. Or you could stop. You could stop. Yeah, no surprise. It evidently was dreadful, but shockingly, people actually
read it. Quite powerful.
Yeah. You know, on Goodreads, where there are 9 million reviews of absolutely every book, there were reviews of
it. There's no review on Goodreads. There can't be.
There absolutely is. There are reviews
above
on Goodreads of Benito Mussolini's book. Yeah. Okay. So happy birthday, Mussolini.
It shows a certain pathology.
Why are you wishing Mussolini a happy birthday?
Well,
I'm just curious.
I'm just thinking.
Hitler was a failed visual artist. He was a painter.
Yes.
So there's some kind of frustration.
Someone very close to us, our family, firmly believes that the Vienna School of Arts had accepted Hitler because that's where he wanted to go. We might not have had.
Yeah.
They rejected him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a theory. Okay. David, last thing happened today. You're the only one I know that would know this. In 1991, Yankee Stadium fans throw cups and blow up dolls at Jose Canseco. Okay. Why would they have done that?
Because he was Jose Canseco.
With a blow up dolls part.
If
you know and it's too racy, you can stop.
No, I wish I had an explanation. I am assuming that it had something to do with performance-enhancing material that he may or may not have been taking.
Got it.
We don't know for sure.
No.
And we can't say for sure because
asterisk.
That would be actionable, as I like to say.
Someone we know has said that.
Yes.
Sure.
gotten in trouble.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
Moving on.
Allegedly, as we like to say.
All right. Now we're going to shift to one of the many reasons we're here at East City Bookshop at 645 Pennsylvania Avenue South. East. Yeah. David will learn if he's really nice to us. I'll repeat the title of his book a lot. But we're here with Lori Gilman, who is the owner of this store, and you and I have visited a couple of times. It's a fabulous place. People really should come here. There is a nook and a cranny and a book for everybody. You seem like a smart, intelligent, well-educated person. Whatever possessed you in the Amazon age to open a bookstore in 2016?
I was waiting for that. Well, the thing that really, really pushed me to finally do it was annoyance at the fact that I had to drive all the way across town or across the river to Virginia just to buy a book.
In this neck of the wood, it used to be Trover's, right?
It was Trover's, which was our neighborhood store, and we spent a lot of time there. Everybody in the neighborhood went there. They were here for decades and decades. And they closed in 2009, which was really kind of a low point for independent bookstores because you had not only the big box stores, but Amazon had come on very strong when started with books. My kids never realized that, but they started with books. So that was kind of a rough time, but I thought, well, somebody will open a bookstore in this neighborhood, because at that point, every bookstore had closed in town, except there was still a Barnes & Noble downtown, Politics and Prose up on
Borders?
Connecticut.
Wasn't Borders around
then?
Well,
Borders closed. Well, they closed in 2011, so they were there for downtown as well. But there was nothing. We have some great used bookstores, but there was nothing in Southeast, Northeast, Southwest. The only bookstores left were in Northwest. Mm-hmm. So I kept
thinking. Most people, by the way, when they saw the buggy whip manufacturers going out of business, kind of went, okay, that's not a good business to be in. But you thought, you see every other one closing down, but you go, me, why you?
Well, actually, so I had this, it was both annoyance at having to drive across town to a bookstore and thinking that my neighborhood really has a lot of readers. I knew this was a fact. And I also kind of think that great, you know, towns and neighborhoods have good bookstores, and thought my neighborhood should have one. So waiting for someone to open it. And of course, before I got this idea and I couldn't let go of it, my kids were getting older. I was kind of looking at, what am I going to do next? Do I want to keep doing what I'm doing? Do I want to do something different? So I couldn't let go of this idea. So I thought, okay, I'm going to do all the research I can do. I'm going to learn everything about it because I had never done anything in the book business before this. And I thought, this will talk me out of it, right?
this will be the cold water.
Yeah. So I went to bookstore school, which is, well,
stop.
They don't call it that. But
is that a four-year school?
It's
you do it online?
It's a 40-hour school. Mm-hmm. Well, I actually went to Florida, to Amelia Island, and it is a couple, and it's it's sort of recommended by the American Booksellers Association as a place to learn all about this. And literally people were there from all over the country who were either thinking about or had sort of started down the road to or just want to learn more about how to open a bookstore. So 40 hours, you know, 8 hours a day for 5 days, and we learned crash course in, you know, point of sale systems and the terrible margins in bookselling and all the things you need to know. But what I took away from that was, oh, you know, if that'll work any place, it'll work in my neighborhood. So then I really couldn't let it go. And I have to say that we opened in April, the end of April 2016. And the first day there literally was this huge line all day long. Wow. And I thought, okay, now it'll slow down. We can catch our breath. We can figure out what we're doing. And it never really slowed down. So it's grown.
Which is great.
It's great. So it's grown so much faster than I had even projected.
Yeah.
So that was all good.
Talk about, it's like 20 years ago, if you had gone to a bookstore, you'd walk into the bookstore and there'd be shelves and there would be books. And you go, okay. And you'd ask some nice person behind the desk about a book. Now you come in and there is a lot going on. I've been here a few times and there's always some event going on. So talk about the kinds of events you have going on. And I want to do this as respectfully as possible. The 13 book clubs that you host here.
Yes, we...
Not so respectfully.
We do have 13 in-store book clubs. Those are just clubs sponsored by our store. We also have a couple that are private book clubs that just meet in our lounge area.
Talk about why the private book clubs come here to meet in your area.
I think they come here because it's not their space. They can come here and it's they don't have to clean up their house. They, you know, and they like to just be around books and lots of books.
And they need a mediator.
And sometimes they need a mediator. That is my theory about why the book clubs, the in-store book clubs work so well, because, you know, often book clubs are a bunch of friends, people who've known each other for a long time. And
they're friends for a while.
Right.
Then they tend to turn on one another.
Sometimes they have some issues with some power struggles and things like that. Who's going to choose the books? And I think that here, because we provide someone who kind of facilitates the discussion and the book choosing, and it's a neutral space, and nobody has to clean up or cook. We encourage everyone to bring wine and snacks and beer, but nobody has to really be the host. Mm-hmm. So, and I've had people tell me that they really like the in-store book clubs because they truly meet people who are just there to talk about the books. So people, like I had, we have a customer who worked for our council member, and she said, no one in book club knows that I work for the council member, and I love it. So
I just love that this is the safe place for people.
It is, and that's nice. Really, this is like, we've heard people talk about the third space, mm-hmm. and it's that kind of in-between space that's, you know, it's not like a theater, it's not a private home, but it's sort of a public space where public things happen, but you can also feel a little bit of ownership, and it's a safe place to discuss, and, you know, kids come on their way home from school, and if they're a little short, we have a little cup of change that we help them cover their nice. Books, or, you know, they need to call their mom or something, so... It nice. Just fills a space for people.
So who do you have coming up? What authors do you have coming up that you're most interested in?
Oh, these are the questions that always make me completely freeze, and I can't remember a single thing that's happening.
There's a great poster
there. Yes, Mary Lou's Everywhere by Sarah Elaine Smith. That's coming in the middle of August. We have Abby Jimenez, which is coming up very soon, this weekend, I believe. And that's a romance author that has a lot of interest. We have
She's no Mussolini, though.
we'll see. We'll see. Let's hope she's not. and we have probably an average of at least two author events every week, in addition to all those book clubs, and sometimes other events like this. So they're all online. We have little bookmarks around the store that have them all listed out. And it honestly, sometimes I can't even think of what's coming up because
there are so many things.
There's so many
That's
things.
That's a great problem to have.
Now we're looking at into March, what we're going to be having here in March. So
yeah, you and I were talking before the show, and I really believe this. The Amazons, the Facebooks, the Googles of the world, all the tech has created an environment in which if you didn't want to have any human interaction, you don't have to. And I don't see any advantages to that, but I think increasingly one of the things we're feeling and sensing, and the reason places like this are successful, is because people are now seeking human interaction, and they want to hold things and touch things, and they want to actually interact with real people as living people. And I think it's a great, hopefully a long-term a very profitable business for you. But I think it's a great public service. It's an absolutely great public service. So we're going to do another segment here on Freshman Reading. I want you to stay with it for a minute, okay? Because you're going to wave the magic wand. So Freshman Reading, again, we're almost in August. And if you're a freshman, you should be putting down that phone. You should be putting down binging something on Netflix and thinking about
the society.
Yeah, exactly. and thinking about your freshman reading, and I am fascinated by the depth and breadth and the diversity of what freshmen are supposed to be reading at college campuses. So I'll just throw a few of these out here, and you guys yell out. University of Oregon. And this one I looked up because I had never heard of it. Under the Feet of Jesus by Helena Maria Vermontes. Have you ever heard about this? It's a novel about immigrant workers, but it's one of these. And we seem to have a lot of authors. They're novels, it's fiction, but it's based on a lot of reality and very real practical influences on people's lives. So you think about immigrant workers in people think California, but think in Oregon and students going to the University of Oregon. There was a huge, huge, huge immigrant problem in that part of the world. So I understand why they picked that one. I get that. Mm-hmm. Harvard, of course they picked Educated by Tara Westover.
Of course.
Of course. Of course. Have you had her here?
No.
Yeah, no.
We would love to. But
I don't know.
Yeah, it's an amazing story.
It's an amazing story. I put it in the category of, is it Wild? Cheryl Strayed, yeah. And Hillbilly Elegy, mm-hmm. where when they stuck to the facts of what they were going through, whether it was hiking the Pacific Coast Trail or Tara doing what she was doing, trying to get an education, or Hillbilly Elegy, what he actually went through, I liked it. And then when they got into, but I have grand theories on life and philosophy mm-hmm. and psychology because I hated it. But Tara Westover, when we first started this show in November, we talked about the lasting value of Tara Westover and Educated on the bestseller list. And she's still there.
Still there. Still there.
It's pretty remarkable. Okay. UVA School of Engineering and Applied Science, Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup. This is Theranos, Elizabeth Holmes.
That makes sense.
Every day somebody reads about Elizabeth Holmes and what a horrible person she is makes me happy.
But this should be on the medical school's reading list as well.
It should be on every tech company's list. Yeah. It should be on every reporter who covers the tech industry, the healthcare industry, because so many of them were so snookered. I also have a longstanding.
That's every report. Every report. Every industry.
I have a longstanding request
they have
to John Kerry.
Our first name, Tori. You know that.
Yeah, we are. We're trying to get him to come in the spring for the paperback.
I don't think he does a lot. I don't think does a lot. And I've seen him. This is John Kerry of the Wall Street Journal who broke the story when everyone else is putting Elizabeth on the cover of their magazines on the front page of everything, declaring her literally the next Steve Jobs. Mm-hmm. He was the one who broke the story. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very serious guy. Yeah, served lots of beer and wine.
Yeah, that is. Here we go.
Okay. I threw in, and then we'll get to my favorite one at the end with Lawrence University, but I threw in, this is not college, but a school in the DMV area, high school, it's a girls' school, private school, and they have two books that they're supposed to be reading in time for the fall. And the one I get, and the one is Color of Water, A Black Man's Tribute to His White Mother by James McBride.
I get that.
Yeah, 19. Good book, understand that, right? The other one is In Cold Blood by Truman Capote.
Why?
Why? David, why?
Because it's a really good book.
It's a really good book.
It is.
Michael is the teacher of high school students.
For this particular
age group. Would you put In Cold Blood?
Well,
juniors in high school.
As we zoom out from all these lists, the first word that I think of is purpose. What is the purpose that we're assigning any of these books? And I think at the undergraduate level, so much of it has to do with building community. And if we think back to the first book you mentioned, it's a very privileged position to be a college freshman. And I think getting reminders about an often forgotten workforce, no matter where you are, whether that is a problem that is at your front door or whether you are just walking by somebody who might be on staff that you forget about every single day as you walk back to your dorm. That's a powerful reminder. With the example of the secondary school, I think about perspective and I think about looking from one single act and trying to see it from a variety of viewpoints. And I think particularly with a group of girls at that age, I'm thinking about what was dominating our news cycle last September and October that had a lot to do with perspective, memory, how you experienced events. And I think trying to gain the experience and the sort of know-how in an academic setting to be able to separate yourself from that primary situation on the page and maybe try and tackle it as a group could be where the value is and the purpose in that setting.
So is that why you're saying In Cold Blood makes sense?
I don't know the school. I'm trying to tackle why.
It doesn't make sense to me at any level.
Well, especially those two together.
Right.
I mean, yeah. Like maybe if you had In Cold Blood with Furious Hours by Casey Sepp, which is a relatively new book that came out this year. She's on the Eastern Shore, by the way. She would make a wonderful guest.
Go. Okay, that's close. DMV is good.
It looks into Harper Lee, but because Harper Lee was such good friends with Truman Capote, it looks into the writing of In Cold Blood and what this new kind of genre of true crime was really about and what really was truth and what wasn't. So that would be interesting.
I read that book when I was 14.
No, it's a great book, but I don't understand why that would be of the two books that you would...
And to Michael's point, there should be, whether we agree with it or not, there's some purpose to the reading that is selected. Mm-hmm. And so then seeing In Cold Blood, juniors in high school in D.C. made me look up on of all the colleges and the universities, and it's called common reading usually. What are they? I couldn't find it on anybody else's list. There's a lot of commonality with a lot of these books. Tara Westover's everywhere, but I could not find In Cold Blood anywhere. So God bless those girls.
But what if then the common experience is we have a generation where their children are going through high school, and we want the parents to be able to have that conversation with the kids at home as the extension of that classroom experience. I mean, that to me is the issue with required reading. We don't have the window into the thinking as to why this is necessary or even valuable to their academic program.
Yeah, yeah. It was not Vizzy. It was not Jeannie.
It was not my high school.
It was not visitation. It was not
Team White.
It's interesting that there's not much fiction on there. On that list.
If you looked at every college and university, you would find more. Okay, so...
But to that point, you probably have reading lists throughout the entire year that are dominated by fiction, and some of these choices might be trying to give them the, you would call it the background knowledge so that they're armed to actually understand the fiction in a meaningful way when they get to that during the school year.
Yeah, and I would argue that Educated by Tara Westover is probably a lot of fiction. I would argue.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Well, she's not going to be on this show. Okay.
Evidently.
Lawrence University in Appleton, Wisconsin. This is thanks to Ed Butt.
This is
one of our best listeners.
Fascinating.
Both Tony's show and this show. Lawrence University in Appleton, Wisconsin. You probably haven't heard a lot about it. This is the freshman reading for this fall. Native Garb by Natasha Trethewey. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
I think so.
Collection of short stories.
Actually, it's poems.
Poems, okay, thank you. Honeybee Democracy by Thomas Seeley. Housekeeping by Marilyn Robinson. The Republic by Plato. Landscape with a Fall of Icarus by Bruegel. And by the way, kids, if you're in Appleton going to Lawrence University, that's just the fall. You got more coming up in the winter and the spring. So
I'm assuming the Bruegel is a painting?
It's a painting, but there's a William Carlos Williams poem about the painting, so I'm wondering if
that's the title of the poem
was on the reading list, and then they looked at the painting and
it's pretty remarkable.
That's fascinating.
I've talked to Ed about
his, pretty heavy duty
his reading. This school was so intensive in its reading requirements, and even now when they go back for reunions, before their reunion, the class is given a book to read. To discuss.
It's a barrel of monkeys at Lawrence University.
No, there's a fair share of white wine drinking and beer drinking
going,
as well.
They're not going 30 miles north to Green Bay, I see.
but they all sit and talk about the book they've just read before the reunion. Yeah.
And he will actually read off to you the number of graduates who go on to extraordinary things from Lawrence University. So God bless them. Yeah. Thanks, Ed. Okay, we'll get out of this segment with this. And this time I'm going to start with you, Lori, and Michael, you get to go last. But if you could wave a little magic literary wand and say freshmen have to read this book this fall, what would it be?
Well, it just came out, so this will work. We talked about this earlier. I would go with Nickel Boys, Colson Whitehead's newest novel.
I'm halfway through. It's remarkable.
Oh, putting me on the spot. Well, since it's the 50th anniversary, I always think Tom Wolfe's a great writer, so The Right Stuff, I think,
would always be a great. Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up. I completely forgot to put on the list for this evening.
Yes.
David, why is that pertinent, not just the 50th anniversary?
I think anything that explores why people are willing to risk their own lives for no particular aggrandizement of their own, just because they think somebody has to do this. Somebody has to be the person to push the envelope, as they say throughout the book. And what makes a person do that? Much like we've talked about with Richard Ben Kramer, what makes somebody run for president? Why? It's a ridiculously unfulfilling job and what kind of person thinks they can actually do it. So
crazy people.
Yeah. And so in this same vein,
yeah. Different kind of crazy.
These are different kind of crazy people, but they are, I don't think they were thrill seekers. I don't think they were, they weren't, they didn't have a death wish. I don't think, they honestly believed that somebody had to do this and that they had the combination of traits that were necessary to do it.
Yeah. It'd be really nice if we could further this conversation with some enlightenment from a book report about the right stuff.
I'm taking notes over here. This was very well said, Mr. Aldridge.
What's that song in the year 2525? We'll get it. We'll get it. Jeannie?
It's going to blow us
out. I'm just pulling this completely out of the back of my brain, but I would want them to read something by Joan Didion just because of her cynicism. Incredible precision, maybe Slouching Toward Bethlehem or Panic in Needle Park or something like that, just to give them a little bit of a dark
side nice
to
kick.
Life.
Yeah. Good. Michael?
I'm going to get the author's name wrong here, so please forgive that. But this is a book that was sent to me by my father-in-law, and we actually designed classes together. This is called The Club by Takis Verger. It is it's not a perfect novel. This is, in terms of required reading, it's what I want to use it for in conversation. This looks at privilege and class, and it understands how you're going to contribute to the environment in which you are in. It looks at a young man who enters a university. He had this idyllic, beautiful childhood, lost his parents, his aunt sends him away, and all of a sudden he is tasked with this mission. He needs to join the secret boxing society at Cambridge. And what happens when you become too close to your subject? And it's a young man trying to figure out his place in the world. I want to use a book for required reading like this that has holes in it. You can attack this book. It's not perfect, but I think it's the conversation that follows. And I really enjoyed questioning my own role as I walk into that. And I try and see, well, how is someone going to look at me here? Because people often forget he had this troubled background and he embodies the sort of that perfect Cambridge society man who can knock your face out. And it's still a little bit of just sort of pure fun. I mean, if you've been watching cable TV, you've seen The Skulls, which is an early 2000s terrible Yale secret society movie, but you watch it for 20 minutes and see the Erg scene, and it gets you lost in that world of sort of intrigue and class and Ivy League, just everything.
I like that one. I would like to go with Nickel Boys, but I don't want to repeat yours. And I really hadn't thought about this in advance, but I'm sitting here looking at David Epstein's book, who's going to join us a minute range. Because it so upends conventional wisdom. And I think so many people race into college and think, oh, I've got to do this, got to do this. And what this says is, no, you need to open your mind. You need to take a deep breath. You need to try lots of different things. So I think that would be an excellent book.
Nice.
Okay.
Nice segue.
Lori, thank you. Every once in a while
thank
it works.
You.
We are at eCity Bookshop. We are very happy to be here. Thank you for your hospitality. Your team is terrific, by the way. And everyone should come here at 645 Pennsylvania Avenue. But we're going to swap. We're going to take a break. We're going to swap you out with David.
Thank
and we'll
you,
be back
everyone.
In just a minute. Thanks, Lori.
Thank you,
okay, we're back. It's Chatter on Books. We're at a disclosed location, the eCity Bookshop, Pennsylvania Avenue. Now, we've been in an undisclosed location a few times, so it's nice to be out in the open where people can find us. And we're talking to David Epstein, who you are blowing minds, just driving type A angsty people crazy. And there are a lot of them here in the DMV, so we're so happy to have you. I'm reaching for David's book, which is called Range, Why Generals Triumph in a Specialized World. And David, the rule here at Chatter on Books is if we like you and you're smart and funny and you make us seem smart and funny, we'll mention your book's name a lot and I'll hold it up.
Okay.
And if you don't, it just kind of goes face down. So
mean and unfunny.
And this segment's going to be really fast.
Okay. Smart and funny. Got it.
Smart and funny.
No problem.
So, and fast. So it is a fabulous book and we will get to it, but we like to start with you. Where did you come from, and did you really want to be an astronaut when you were young? Because we seem to have several authors on who claim to have wanted to be astronauts when they were young.
Oh, I absolutely did. I grew up outside Chicago.
Where?
And in Evanston, and I absolutely did. In fact, my plan was to go to the U.S. Air Force Academy, become a test pilot, and then an astronaut.
Did you go to space camp?
I did.
Michael Crowley, exactly.
Yes.
And
there,
I,
you, You and Mike can correspond now.
Okay. And I got the congressional recommendation for the Air Force Academy. I did the throwing a basketball from my knees and all that kind of stuff.
From whom?
From a deceased, well, now deceased congressman from Illinois. And I did the physical tests and everything where I had to throw a basketball from my knees is one of the ones I remember and run a 600. But then I decided not to go. My counselor was very confused when my choices came down ultimately to Columbia and the Air Force Academy because she viewed those as on rather opposite ends of the spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You were kind of a jock, right? You were a runner.
Mm-hmm. Well, I played football, basketball, baseball in high school before running. Yeah.
That's all. That's all. Which was your favorite?
Which was my favorite? Well, ultimately, running became like a life skill for me. So that became my favorite. But early on, I fell in love with baseball as a kid. I went through phases. It kind of depended. Mm-hmm. When I was in middle school, I think basketball was the thing. Before that, it was baseball. And then it depended what season it was, really.
Kind of a generalist in the making, but you didn't know it.
That was right? Set you up for that. So
yeah,
do
you
I get
did.
A,
exactly. Okay, one.
Started
okay. One.
That's
okay.
Looking good.
We'll hold up the book range one more time. Okay, so day job. Reporter, Sports Illustrated, ProPublica, investigative reporter. How did those jobs or do they help you this book range and your other book, Sports Gene, which is a bestseller, great book. How did your day job help you figure out these books?
Well, honestly, before I was those things, I mean, I was living in a tent in the Arctic when I decided to try to become a writer. I was training to be a geologist.
We hear that all the time.
And that science background really helped, right? So a lot of when I decided to get off that track, I got to Sports Illustrated as a temp fact checker about 6 years older than the people I was temp fact checking for, but pretty soon realized that my rather ordinary science skills were totally extraordinary in the context of a sports magazine. And so I sort of zoomed from temp fact checker to the youngest senior writer in a couple of years because of taking something, you know, it's like intellectual arbitrage of taking something ordinary in one area and putting it where it's extraordinary. And so that really became probably the most useful thing for my books in a lot of ways. I mean, the Sports Gene in Sports Illustrated was sort of obvious. I was the science writer at Sports mm-hmm. Illustrated, and I had all these questions about the balance of nature and nurture in sports from my own sports participation and my own sports viewing that I wanted to investigate, basically.
You know Scott Price?
Absolutely.
Sports Illustrated.
So
he was our second author. He was one of our favorites.
I saw him on your Instagram.
On the Instagram. Yeah, he's very smart. Okay.
He's funny, too.
I took a few beers, but yeah. Okay. So we're talking about range, why generalists triumph in a specialized world, and there are lots of different ways we could get at this book, which is really pretty remarkable. But I love the people part of it. And to talk about the people, we got to start with Roger Federer and Tiger Woods.
Yeah.
They're kind of the essence or the simplest way of you presenting what this book is about. So give us Roger and Tiger.
And I just thought of one
and
other
Michael,
thing.
And Michael, the golfer in the world, you get to object if you disagree.
I'm staying out of this.
By the way, I just thought of one other thing about how ProPublica specifically led me to this book, and maybe that's kind of... I was doing some reporting there about standard practices in medical care that are very popular but have been shown by very good evidence not to work or to be harmful, but they continue to become more popular, and that got me interested in some of the perverse effects of medical specialization, and that's like some of what...
Is that the terrifying story about the cardiologist in the conference?
And the stents.
That's where I was reporting.
Go ahead. Commercial break on why to be terrified.
Well, there's a cardiologist convention and they're not in the hospital.
They're
backups. The B team is at the hospital.
Right. So this is a study that found if you're checked in for certain cardiac problems to a hospital on a date of a national cardiology convention, a teaching hospital particularly, you're less likely to die because a lot of the cardiologists are away, and a lot of the very specialized, very prominent cardiologists are more likely to do procedures that have not been proven to help but have some risk with them. So I think specialization in medicine has been inevitable and beneficial, but there are also some very perverse effects of it.
Okay, back to Roger and Tiger.
Okay. So I think that the Tiger Woods story probably... Even if you don't know the details, people have sort of absorbed the gist, which is, you know, father gave him a putter when he was 7 months old. He was very physically precocious, not trying to turn him into a golfer, just giving it to him. 10 months old, he starts imitating a swing. 2 years old, you can go on YouTube and see him on national television.
Mike Douglas Show.
Mike Douglas Show, exactly. You know, fast forward to age 21, he's...
Great, I'm taking notes for the hammer.
Fast forward to 21, he's the best golfer in the world. And it was very much 10,000 hours kind of story. Roger Federer, who I think is clearly every bit as famous as an adult athlete, traveled a pretty different path. He played some badminton, basketball, soccer, His mother was a tennis coach but refused to coach him because he wouldn't return balls normally. And he added some rugby, swimming, wrestling, skiing, handball, volleyball. And when his coaches wanted to move him up to a higher level against older boys, he declined because he just wanted to talk about pro wrestling with his friends after practice. And when he eventually got good enough to warrant an interview with his local paper, the reporter asked him, if you ever become a pro, what will you buy with your first paycheck? And he says a Mercedes. And his mother, who doesn't want him putting all his eggs in the sports basket, is appalled by this and asks the reporter if she can hear the interview tape. And the reporter obliges. And it turns out he said Mercedes in Swiss German. He just wanted more CDs, not a Mercedes. So she was fine with that. So both of these guys obviously got to the height, the pinnacle of their domain by very different paths, only one of which we hear about. And my question was, which one of these is the norm?
Norm or better?
Both.
And
both.
Happier.
And happier. I actually tried to stay away from some of the health stuff.
That you did.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because
we're
going to
dive right in.
Yeah. Because having written about injuries and brain trauma and all these things when I was at Sports Illustrated, it did start to occur to me that those actually don't influence most parents. They're much more focused on performance. So I actually didn't want to introduce that, and I wanted to stay focused on performance because I thought that was a message that was kind of less out there, and I had felt from experience that the other message was less impactful. Mm-hmm. Because I mean, obviously, if like the health of children were the paramount, then like we probably wouldn't have some of the sports we have, right? So I wanted to look at another side.
It's so interesting if you go back to the golf world in that post 1997 Tiger world, and you look at just the majors this year, where obviously Tiger has his tournament of the last 10 years and wins in just great comeback fashion. But then you look at the U.S. Open, where Gary Woodland, who famously played college basketball, mm-hmm. and then you have Brooks Koepka, who will be the back-to-back player of the year, wins the PGA up in New York, and he wins the most recent WGC event, who famously doesn't really like to practice. He says, "I play golf when you see me on TV." Showed up 45 minutes before his tee time.
What'd you say?
Sunday
showed up this weekend,
McElroy.
His shoes weren't tied.
Yeah.
Half an hour before tee time.
But he is someone whose family comes from a baseball background. He played a bunch of sports growing up, and there seems to be, you have that balance in terms of how he approaches that sport, where he has done the preparation, but he still is looking outward as to who he is and how he defines himself.
David, athletes, generalists versus specialists.
Well, certainly we have seen in all sports the last 10 or 15 years, but particularly in pro basketball, a race to get started with your basketball career as soon as possible, sometimes as early as age 6 or 7, to the exclusion of everything else. And, when we were growing up, when I was growing up, you were more likely to be a multi-sport athlete. People played everything. They played baseball. They played basketball. They played
football.
There
were seasons. And you played a different sport each season.
And you played different sports to stay in shape, but you also played different sports just to use different muscle groups. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing now, and ESPN just wrote a very detailed story on this, that basketball players are suffering very serious injuries much earlier in their careers because all they do is play basketball. And there are studies, one at the University of Wisconsin, that says if you are viewed as someone who is exclusively a basketball player, exclusively you spend a certain amount of time or a certain number of months per year, I think it's 8 months out of the year, either practicing or playing, you are much more likely to suffer a knee or hip injury because that's all you do. You don't do anything else. And so I think that's part of what we're seeing. It's part of the trade-off, to your point, is that I don't know that it necessarily is a better mousetrap, but it is the way that particular sport has gone.
I don't know enough to say that a lot of Tiger's problems were because of specialization, but man, he was so focused, so intense. And I've heard you say and others say that the father never forced him, that he wanted to play. He is 7 months old. He was not saying, "I want to play golf." Somebody put that stick in his hand and kept it there. But that kind of intense laser-like focus could not have been good for him emotionally. It could not, I don't think. And I think we saw that in the later years, what happened to his career.
Maybe. I don't know. I don't know how to speculate on his psychology. But I actually think that there is, well, first to David's point, there's actually, even for those kids who are, the specialization definition in most of those studies is 8 or more months a year and no other sports. There's actually seems to be in some of these studies a protective effect of playing other sports. Mm-hmm. Even if you are doing it, which is interesting, like, and some serious athletic outfits have adopted this. So, like, I spent some time with the physiologist for Cirque du Soleil. They have lots of Olympians and, you know, incredible performers. And they saw this, and they started having their performers learn the basics of three other performers' disciplines. Subjectively, they thought it made them more creative in designing, you know, their performances. But objectively, they measure their injury rates next to Canadian gymnastics, and they dropped their injury rates by, like, 30%. And,
wow.
And for them, they've got to think this is pretty serious to, mm-hmm. to take time away from the main, you know, the main discipline to do that. But Tiger, you know, I actually think there is a potential, again, just looking at the performance standpoint, for specialization to work in golf, early specialization. But as I sort of outline in the book, golf, which has been extrapolated in all these best-selling books to everything you want to learn in the world, is actually a uniquely poor model of almost everything else humans want to learn, including the other sports.
Yep. Okay, moving on from sports. So everybody knows Vincent van Gogh, who's in your book. I doubt many people know Francis Hesselbein. So give us, say, 15 seconds on Vince and why he's in your book, and a lot more on Francis.
15 seconds. Okay. Vince had about five different careers, all of which he dove into with this incredible gusto at every one of those careers: bookseller, a pastor in training, a teacher, an art dealer. All of his colleagues remarked on his incredible endurance. And so he had these ecstatic starts and then totally flamed out until he's approaching 30, buys a book called The Guide to the ABCs of Drawing, and kicks off his art career.
Who knew a book like that existed at the time? Yeah. I went to look for that. Okay. And Francis.
Oh, Francis. So how many seconds do I get on this one?
More. That was good. You saved time on Vince, so now you've got as much as you want on Francis.
And then I just burned the time by asking how much time I had to. Okay.
It's Range by David Epstein, folks. Get the book.
Okay, more jokes. Francis Hesselbein, who's a character in the book, was born in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. She dropped out of college at 17 because her father was passing away to take care of her own family. Worked as sort of an assistant. That was kind of the only job she ever applied for. She got married. Her husband went away to World War II and was a combat air photographer. Came back. They settle in Johnstown. He sets up a photography office, and she turns into the odd jobs person. Like, whatever needs to get done, she does it, basically. And when she's in her mid-30s, a prominent woman from her area comes and asks her to be the volunteer head of a Girl Scout troop. And she says, no, I have a son. I don't know anything about that. And the woman says, okay, well, we'll just have to disband these girls from, you know, modest backgrounds who meet in a church basement. She says, fine, 6 weeks, and then find a real person. And she does it, and she sort of falls in love with it and stays with them for 7 years, and then says, okay, now I'm done with that. And long story short, she keeps getting... People keep coming to her and saying, like, we'd like you to do this with the Girl Scouts. And she keeps saying no. And they say, well, if not, like, you know, something's going to fall through.
Party's over.
Yeah. So they tell her, like, they're going to, we want you to lead a United Way campaign. And by the way, I think the second woman to lead one of these United Way campaigns was, like, last year. And Francis was the first, you know, in the mid-20th century. And they say, well, Girl Scouts going to lose its partnership with United Way if you don't step up. So fine, I'll do it and then find a real leader. And that year, Johnstown, Pennsylvania has the highest per capita giving in the country. And she keeps on taking these jobs when somebody says to her, somebody's got to do it. And she keeps saying 6 weeks, then find a real leader. And she keeps staying. In her mid-50s, she decides to take an actual role, an actual professional paid job with the local Girl Scouts Council. And later on, she gets called to interview for the CEO job. And the previous CEOs of the Girl Scouts had, like, unbelievable credentials. Captain Dorothy Stratton had started the Women's Coast Guard Reserve in World War II. She'd been a university dean, a psychology professor, all sorts of experience in industry. The previous CEO, Cecily Kanan Selby, she had, you know, gone to Harvard or Radcliffe, which was at the time the women's college, before college age, and made breakthroughs in the study of cells and all these sorts of things. Frances was one of 355 local Girl Scout Council directors. And she, like she did with everything, she declined the interview. And her husband, you know, who had been in photography and film, said, well, I've always wanted to live in New York. So if you're going to decline, I'm going to drive you there and you can say no in person. So she goes for the interview, and she's not nervous about it because she's not taking the job. And they say, what would you do with Girl Scouts? And she outlines a total transformation of kind of a hidebound organization, saying, I would throw out the handbook. You need multiple handbooks that appeal to girls of different ages and girls of different backgrounds.
Big emphasis on diversity.
Huge emphasis on diversity. She says the leadership should represent the people that we want to attract, you know, all these sorts of things. And they offer her the job. And so she arrives in 1976. So having had her first professional job at age 54, She arrives in her 60s as the CEO of the Girl Scouts, completely turns it around, increases membership, adds 130,000 volunteers. These are people she's paying in a sense of mission, not in money. She increases minority participation by like a third. So she gets rid of those handbooks and she commissions artists that says, if an indigenous girl near an ice floe in Alaska opens one of these books, I want her to see her in a Girl Scout uniform. And everyone told her, no, too soon, fix the financial stuff, then worry about diversity. And she said, no, diversity is the problem, so we're going to do that first. She turns around and basically saves the organization. And the famed management expert Peter Drucker names her the greatest CEO in America, and says she should take over GM when there's a vacancy. And so she decides, she's like with everything, she says, now I retire from the Girl Scouts, I'm going to go back home to Pennsylvania and write a book. And she gets a call the next day from an insurance company. And she had been on the board and they said, come see your office. She says, what are you talking about? I don't have an office. And they realized that her whole life, she never knew what she was going to do next. They said, just take it and you'll figure something out. Mm-hmm. And so today she is running the Frances Hesselbein Leadership Institute from there, teaching at West Point at the ripe young age of 103 and a half, 5 days a week in Manhattan. Mm-hmm.
So we see the value of generalists like Frances, but there are some cultures that are entrenched with specialists, and the two I think that most of us probably come up against are the operating room and the cockpit. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We want specialists mm-hmm. in those jobs. What can a generalist bring to those worlds, the operating room and the cockpit, that would benefit everyone?
That's a great question. I appreciate that. Jeannie
wins so far.
Flash the book for Captain.
I didn't do anything.
That's all right. It's tangential range.
Thanks. So starting with the operating room, it is, and I mentioned this in the book because I want to point out that specialists work better than generalists in some areas. It depends on the domain.
We want a neurosurgeon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in fact, specialized surgeons have fewer complications than mm-hmm. less specialized surgeons. Not only that, but even on top of the number of times they've done a surgery, something else about being specialized causes them to have fewer complications. That said, they're also much more likely to do a surgery on someone who doesn't actually need it, which can cause a lot of risks, right? So one of the most popular orthopedic surgeries in the world is partial meniscus repair. Like you have knee pain, you go in, if there's not acute, but if you just have knee pain, you go in, there's a tear in this crescent piece of fiber in your knee, they shave it back to the crescent shape,
but
and you go
home. But is a generalist going to be able to say to the orthopedic surgeon, hold up there, don't do that?
What the generalists are good at is evaluating, zooming out and evaluating the evidence. So the problem with the specialists in medicine is they're so specialized, they all work now in what's called surrogate markers. So they're not looking at the organism you care about, right? The whole person, the outcomes you care about. So in this case, the meniscus, they shave the knee back. So finally, some more generalist doctors decided to do a study on the outcomes you actually care about, which is not did you fix the meniscus, but did the person get better? And they did this in Finland, and the control arm was sham surgery. People who go in, they get an incision, they bang around like it's surgery, sewn back up without doing anything. And they did just as well and recovered quicker. And so the generalists are often zoomed out. Instead of looking at did we fix the meniscus, is did we actually get the outcomes we care about? And now it's turning out that in all these cases, we're finding, blood pressure medications where they lower blood pressure, they alter some part of your circulatory system, but people die of heart attack and stroke at the exact same rate with better blood pressure numbers. And so the generalists have zoomed more out and said, instead of looking at these surrogate markers that the specialists have to focus on, and that is important for research, we want to look at the outcomes that you actually care about. And so I think it's the specialists and the generalists in partnership that really is.
And so how could a generalist say to a pilot in a cockpit,
yeah,
you're not God, here's another way to look at this problem with this airplane that seems to be in distress somehow.
Yeah.
I mean, would a pilot accept that kind of...
In the air, no. I mean, I don't think the passengers should start weighing in.
The stewardess says, hey.
But no, especially...
I have an idea.
Pilots are great. In fact, and I mentioned this in the book, almost three quarters of commercial air accidents, and that doesn't necessarily mean a crash, but something that wasn't supposed to happen on a crew's first day of working together. So not only do you want, when you go by the cockpit, you should ask, guys work together before? If they say no, get your drinks early.
Don't tell this to Tony Kornheiser get him off every plane.
But I think, and when things go as expected, that's sort of what I talk about in the book, when things don't change much, when work next year looks like it did last year, you actually want those specialists. The problem is when something unusual happens, the specialist will often stick to certain routines, even when to an outsider it becomes clear that it's ridiculous. I was actually recently just talking about this with the head of safety at Delta, who is a pilot, and he said he has a sign on his door that says, "Stop thinking like a pilot." And what he wants to... What he says the pilots will often do is they will comply with all the things they're supposed to do. And he says what we want is safety first, compliance second. Mm-hmm. If you need to break compliance, you should do that. But he said that becomes very difficult for people who are used to routines over and over and over. So I think this is something that has to be incorporated into training. And this sort of classic research finding that breadth of training predicts breadth of transfer. So transfer is your ability to take your skills and knowledge and apply them to a scenario you haven't quite seen before, and what predicts your ability to do that is how broad your training was. So I think we need to broaden people's training.
Can you talk a little bit of Andre Geim, only winner of the Nobel Prize and the Ig Nobel Prize?
Yeah.
And people have questions. Get ready. We're going to take a break here soon in a second and get some questions from the audience.
So the Ig Nobel Prize is a prize.
Ig space Nobel.
Yeah. Is awarded for the kind of silliest or most frivolous research of the year. And they actually ask people if they are willing to accept it before announcing it because of like the reputational concerns. It has its logo is the Thinker statue, but it's fallen over on the ground on its back. And it's called the Stinker. And so Andre Geim won he's a physicist who won the Ig Nobel for one of his what he calls Friday night experiments, where on Friday nights he has the lab just do stuff that doesn't have a grant and that they don't have to apply to do and they don't have to know what they're going to get. They just experiment. And he won that for experiment where he levitated frogs with very strong electromagnets. Those frogs have a lot of water.
You might need to explain that a little bit. I had to read more when I read that.
Well, basically frogs, well, kind of everything, but especially frogs because they have a lot of water are diamagnetic or they're opposed by magnetic fields. And so he used very strong magnets and put a frog between them and it levitated between the magnets.
I know some people I would like to have this happen to.
Fill them full of water and frogs. And so he won the Ig Nobel for that. And for another one of his Friday night experiments was a little more productive. He came up with an adhesive that is mimicked on geckos' feet. Uh-huh. And then for yet another one that started with scotch tape ripping off layers of basically pencil lead, that led to the discovery of the first single atom thick material, which was thought to be only theoretical, called graphene. And he won the Nobel Prize for that. And in the end of the book, I used him in the end of the book because I wanted to focus on specialists who managed to find ways to maintain the benefits of breadth anyway, even within their specialization. And with his Friday night experiments, that's essentially what he does. And he says he likes to change his research area every 5 years. He said it's not psychologically comfortable, but he said he likes to say that he doesn't do research, only search. Mm-hmm. And I think there needs to be room for that sort of thing if we want to have those sorts of breakthroughs.
Are you a generalist or a specialist?
It's interesting because it's a semantic issue at some degree, right? Because when I became a science writer, and especially a sports science writer, other journalists viewed me as specialized, whereas I was coming from, you know, grad school and then going to writing, so I view myself for sure as a generalist. And I think my science background certainly informs what I do and helps, but every project I take on, I'm like a beginner. By the time one of my projects is out in the world, I'm already feeling like a freshman in whatever else I'm doing, for sure.
Oh, I have a great segue, because I think we didn't serve enough beer and wine to our gang here. They're not dying to, because you're intimidating, so they're not dying to ask questions. But I'll get you out on this.
Me?
Yeah, you. Yeah. But we still
look like
story.
I'm like 16 years old. How am I intimidating?
We still love your book, Range, by David Epstein, Why Generalists Triumph in a Specialized World. And I found this, not oddly, I found this wonderfully inspiring and reassuring, because I've had 9 million jobs and I'll probably have another 50 before I'm done. And so I read this and go, okay, I'm all right.
It's validation.
I'm okay. It's validation.
Yay, confirmation
bias. But we were
bias.
Talking earlier about freshmen. We'll get you out on this. We were talking earlier about freshmen and what they should be reading. Knowing what you know now, and if you were a freshman in college again, how would you do things differently?
Oh, gosh. You know, that's a great question, but I also think that is not a question that I want to answer very specifically, because I think one of the tenets in... So I ended up being sort of a subject in one of the studies in the book called the Dark Horse Project. That's right. About how people find work with high match quality. That's the term economists use for the degree of fit between someone's interests and abilities and the work they do. And this project was called the Dark Horse Project because all these people would come in for their informational interview and say, well, don't tell people to do what I did, because I started in this other thing, realized it wasn't for me, then did this other thing, and, you know, had to make my own ground. And so I was a, you know, I came out of nowhere. And they named it the Dark Horse Project because the large majority of people viewed themselves as dark horses. Mm-hmm. And those people, instead of making a 10-year plan, they would, their sort of habit of mind was saying, here's who I am right now. Here are my skills and interests. Here are the opportunities in front of me. I'm going to try this one, and then maybe a year from now I'll change because I will have learned something about myself. So I actually think the room to make those zigzags and mistakes was really important for me. And so I don't want to have had anything sort of prescribed in retrospect. I think I like working forward from opportunities instead of having a sort of prescribed plan. I want to say that I would have been a bigger reader because I'm a voracious reader now, and I was not at the time. But I just read There, There by Tommy Orange, which I totally loved, and I looked at this Q&A because I subscribe to the great lover of independent bookstores and subscribe to the Indispensable program. And they ask him his secret to, you know, what he's doing. And he says, late start, got a job in a bookstore. And since I was late, I wasn't overreading. And so I just became voracious about it. And I sort of feel the same way. So it's hard for me to say that I would have for sure changed something. I think I would have just been, you know, I think I would have changed things that have nothing to do with my work. And I think I just would have been, I think I'm pretty nice now. Like I try to try to understand.
You weren't
like what
nice
other people,
before.
No, no.
Okay, we need another half an hour, people.
No. I was nice, but I think just as you mature, you realize like how important it can be to treat everyone you encounter, no matter how you encounter them, with some level of dignity. And I think when you're younger, maybe that doesn't, or at least for me, that just didn't always cross my mind.
Nice. That's lovely. Okay, what's next?
I have no idea. And you know what? No, seriously, I have no idea.
That's the answer we wanted.
No, I know. And I feel like I used to be really sheepish about saying that because that's always my answer after I finish a project. But now I feel like, hey, I wrote the book. Like, I can say that. And it's like it's like on brand for the first time ever.
Giving everybody license to say, I don't know. Okay, it's really fabulous. And I think everybody, not just freshmen going to college, should read Range, Why Generalists Triumph in a Specialized World. David, thank you for being with us. Stay here for a second. We're going to take a quick break, come back with Deserted Island, the last Deserted Island for a few weeks, all right?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We're back. We're back at, with Chatter at Books at East City Bookshop on Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast. We're with David Epstein, who has this fabulous book. I really like Sports Gene. I like this one better. Just saying. Range.
Me too.
Why? Oh, that's nice. Why Generalists Triumph in a Specialized World? We have a question. Go ahead.
So thought leadership is definitely a 21st century buzzword, but one with merit. When Drucker and Welsh and Maxwell dominated the market, they weren't referred to as thought leaders, but with yourself and Sandberg and Grant and Pink and Senek, you guys are looked, your community is looked at as thought leaders. Do you embrace the title of being a thought leader? And with so much content coming out from this great group, do you, how do you screen your ideas and examples and analogies to make sure they haven't been used before?
Gosh, that's an interesting question. Because it is funny. I would say, you know, in some ways, the older I've gotten, like the less seriously I take myself. So I sort of laugh a little in my head when I hear myself called a thought leader. If it means that people are interested in and engaged in my work, then I think that's cool, very cool. But I would never call myself a thought leader. But I really like some of those writers that you mentioned, and so I'm really glad that their work resonates. As far as the choosing the anecdotes, I read a lot, and so I think I have some sense of what's out there. But also, when I'm finding some of these things, I mean, I think here comes some confirmation bias. So my strategy for the first year of both my books is I don't write anything. I try to read 10 scientific journal articles a day every day for the year. And I'm very sometimes I go down a rabbit hole, you know, and I come up a week or two later and I'm like, how did I ever think I was going to write anything about that? And I used to chide myself for that sort of inefficiency. And now I sort of think that that's what gives me this like expansive sort of search function where I end up finding these things that other people haven't. And sometimes I'm pretty aware when I'm in that like people haven't done the story before. And so having put research in this book about how important inefficiency is to breakthrough, I now think that my own inefficiency is actually one of my competitive advantages and helps me find these stories that other people don't find. That could be like tremendous self-justification for being inefficient. I'm not really sure. But But I think it's worked for me so far. Is that a reasonable answer to the question? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Nice. You know, we've had Dan Pink on. I think Dan Pink actually introduced me to you. So God bless Dan Pink. We love him. I love Dan. I love Marie Kondo. And I used to say we bred Marie Kondo and Dan Pink the world would be a better place. Now, if we can get you in on the family, just going to be phenomenal.
This is quite a breeding program.
Yeah, it really is. Cold fusion or something like that. Okay, so this is Deserted Island. We've had some fabulous deserted islands, and we won't have one for a few weeks, but this one might be my favorite. So you're on a deserted island. You come back in your next life, and you're back on the deserted island, which is kind of sad. But you come back as an author. What author are you coming back as? And I'm going to go first because mine is cute and sweet, so not too interesting. You'll be last. Okay? Pop quiz. So mine is Beatrix Potter. And by the way, I learned Beatrix was not her first name. First name was Helen. And she writes these lovely stories, lots of animals. She was a naturalist. She was a conservationist. She knew a lot about botany. So I think you come back and you're on the deserted island for the second time, and you'll be able to hang out with the animals and the flora and the fauna. So I think I'll be good. Michael?
This is really a hard question, so I don't know why this is your favorite of all of our deserted islands.
Because it's very revealing.
I think having Bootsy and the Hammer, Dad, wherever you are, I guess we're sticking with those nicknames. I'm thinking about authors that meant a lot to me as a kid and still resonate. This is an author I mentioned before, Brian Jakes, and this is probably the most influential author on my reading career. And as we're thinking about independent bookstores and sort of the interactions between booksellers and clerks and how they can sort of impact the choices you make, I'm thinking about a local bookstore, Connecticut Avenue, Northwest DC, called Child's Play, where I remember they used to have a small hole in the wall in the back. It's now a much bigger store, where I picked up my first copy of Mossflower, which was my entree into this world of the critters of the Mossflower Forest, good versus evil. My feelings have grown a little bit more complicated. We've had a couple of emailers write to me and talk about how this was an overly simplified world. And much of what I loved about these stories is how sort of textual, how visible this world was. And so much of that was because the author wanted to make this world accessible to kids who didn't have sight. And I think about the books I read now. I'm staring at a book down in the fantasy section that's been just a really fun book for me over the last couple years as I've gotten older, The Name of the Wind series by Patrick Rothfuss. Mm-hmm. And this reader and these readers were questioning, well, you know, this is just sort of creating stereotypes in these kids. This is a very impressionable time. What are they going to take with these lessons going forward? And again, these are books that I've read. You know, this was lower elementary going forward. I read this to Walker when he was a newborn. I read this to him before he was even born. But I think that'd be a really interesting way with sort of the way that we approach reading and the influence it can have on kids now to talk about some of those oversimplifications, which I think were a sign of the time. And I also think are a bit misguided as they tried to give kids the access to understand, oh, I've seen something like this before. I'm able to make a prediction. Predicting is so powerful in reading. I'm able to make a prediction about this character, and that's going to let me get through this chapter book.
I love the concept, the execution, Michael, I have to say. You're going to be on the deserted island by yourself, so it's going to be hard to share a lot of this as that author, but it's still good. It's lovely. It's lovely. Beatrix and I will come visit. Jeannie?
Well, those of you who know me know it is not Emily Dickinson or Jane Austen. I did not want to take this question too seriously, Tori, but I decided if I wanted to come back, deserted island or not, I would come back as Dorothy Parker.
Good one.
Got to sit around the
Algonquin
table.
Yeah, great life.
I've got to trash, you know, famous plays on Broadway and tick off lots of important producers and get herself fired from Vanity Fair. And then could be sort of mean in the name of literary criticism or theater criticism. That's kind of my mean side. And then went out to Hollywood. And this I did not know. She was a writer of the original script for A Star Is Born and won an Academy Award for her screenplay. Shared it with others. Yeah.
Good. You can do books and movies on your deserted island.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Perfect. David?
Were so many choices, mm-hmm. but I came down to, much like Michael, the books, some of the things I remember when I was a child. And so I think I'll be Dr. Seuss, because I could name everything on the island.
A lot of head nodding in the audience.
I could name everything on the island, no matter if that's the actual name of it or not. And I could make things rhyme.
Favorite Dr. Seuss book?
Oh, my gosh. Well, The Cat in the Hat, probably.
Yeah.
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 Great lasting value in that
one. Yes.
Good. I like that a lot. Okay, David?
Well, when you started off with the practical point, I was like, well, the author of Bushcraft or whatever. Mm-hmm. Oh, I don't know who that is. But and then the next thought was Delia Owens. I haven't read Where the Crawdads Sing, which is exploding. Oh. But she's like both a novelist and a zoologist. Oh, so it'd be good to be
excellent
her.
One.
But if I'm thinking about the author, you know, whose head I would kind of most like to be in, it's probably one that most people haven't heard of, Martin McDonagh, an Irish playwright, who's gotten more famous for doing movies, which are not, I think, as good. He did Three Billboards and In Bruges. Wow. But mm-hmm. I think his movies don't hold a candle to some of his plays, like one called The Pillow Man, which I think is, you know, when I read that, I was kind of like, this can go in like the Dante, Cervantes, Shakespeare uh-huh. kind of realm. So I think I'd want to be Martin McDonagh. For one that people have heard of, I'd say maybe Neil Gaiman, because I love his writing range. He connects with so many different people in so many different ages, in so many different genres, and he does, you know, radio, film, like just so many different types of projects. And as someone who likes to experiment in different media and different types of writing, from adults to kids, I think that would be a fun head to be in also.
That's lovely. So Michael can do the books on the island. Jeannie, you can do the movies. David, you and I will do fantasy, and you can do the plays.
Great.
Perfect. Okay. All right. So, David Epstein, really, thank you for being here with us.
My pleasure.
It's Range, Why Generals Triumph in a Specialized World. It's really wonderful to read, and it's really inspiring, I think, for many, many, many people. And, yes, Jeannie is pointing, because I've got some housekeeping to do. If I don't do this tonight, our last show until September, there will just be hell to pay. So we have many, many listeners to the show who are also loyal Littles. We love them. We welcome them all. And they are planning the Summer of Littles 2, which is on August 3rd, 5 p.m. And at least so far, 21 places around the world they will be meeting to get together, because they have to get together every few months. Michael's shaking his head going, I cannot believe these people.
I'm shaking my
but
head.
But at least 21 different places.
I'm trying
places
to make it out to Wardaka.
To Gaithersburg. So it's Wardaka here in Gaithersburg. It's Frankfurt, Michigan. It's Dallas. It's Cincinnati. It's Melbourne, Australia. London, England. Lexington, Kentucky. Soldotna, Alaska. New York. It goes on and on and on. And if you want more information, you can email summeroflittles2, that's the number 2, summeroflittles2@gmail.com. Thank you, Bob, who takes such good care of us. And speaking of taking care of us, thank you to Lori and the gang here at East City Bookshop. You're a great host. Thanks for having us here. For everybody making this happen, Claude and Marcellus, thank you very much. Nothing would happen without you. The C-SPAN gang for being so understanding of our somewhat unusual situation here. Michael, Jeannie, David, it's been a great 8-9 months. We got a few weeks off. We'll come back in September. And David, we hope we get you back for our next book.
I'd love to. Can I say one quick independent bookstore thing?
Of course. We love local independent bookstores.
And you mentioned like the Amazon, Facebooks, and things like that mm-hmm. before that don't have human interaction. But I also think the recommendations algorithm is good for some things, but in bookstores, you find interests you didn't know you had. And that doesn't happen in the recommendations algorithm. That's one thing. So I go to bookstores to find interests I didn't know I had. Two, everyone wants bookstores in their neighborhood, and there's a really easy way to help make that happen. So buy some books
Walk
there.
In. Yeah. Walk in. It's wonderful. There are real people here, and they're very knowledgeable, and they're great. So thanks very much, everybody, for being here, and we will see you in September.